you all are here. And really quickly, my name is David Hainick. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I work for the DMH UCLA Public Mental Health Partnership. And we are a team that works closely with DMH to provide training for primarily for their FSP teams, as well as for the homeless outreach teams. And I understand today we've also been working with the Office of Public Guardian. So I recognize we have a lot of staff from the Office of Public Guardian. So welcome. I'm glad. I know FSP often works closely with you all. So really happy to have you on for today's training. So thanks for making time. A little bit more about me, just so you have some additional background, but not a ton. But I'm new to the Los Angeles area. I've been here about a year and a half. So maybe not that new, but I moved here from New York. And before New York, I lived in New Orleans. And I spent about 11 years in New Orleans. And the reason I bring that up is I reference that in an example later on today. So I also have a small private practice. And so I may reference or may use some examples that are, of course, anonymous, but to help explain some of the points that we're going to go through over the next couple hours. So today's training is called Understanding the Stress Response. And one of the main reasons I put this training together was I do a lot of work with trauma, whether it's providing trainings on trauma or also working with individuals on a clinical level who've experienced a lot of trauma or who have anxiety disorders. And so I've always been really interested in that. And as particularly around post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma-informed care, I was learning more and more about our stress response and just becoming increasingly fascinated by it. So part of this is like, it's something that I'm really interested in, but also it's such an important concept to understand, because it really validates and normalizes many of the experiences that all of us probably experience. So, or not probably, most definitely experience. So, so that's why I thought it was really great and a really important and timely topic, particularly now with COVID. So I initially developed this training right at the start of the pandemic. And I would have never guessed 9 months later, I'd be doing this training again and not too different of a circumstance. So, but anyways, I hope you find this as interesting as I do. So today's learning objectives is we want to classify stressful situations into one of five different stress types. So we'll go through those. And then we want to describe two parts of the brain that have significant roles in responding to stress. Now, I want to emphasize that I'm only selecting two parts of the brain. I know that sounds kind of odd, but I thought the ones that were most applicable, the stress response, and I'll say this over and over, it's incredibly complex. And not being a doctor, like some of this, it's the level of detail and complexity is really overwhelming. So I really just narrowed it down to two pieces, the amygdala and the hypothalamus. So we're going to talk about those today. And then we're going to talk about two chemicals that are involved in the process. Again, there are so many different elements to this. I'm only picking the two that are somewhat familiar, and that's adrenaline and cortisol. So we're going to talk about those and what their role is in the stress response, and also look at some of the negative consequences that they have when they are constantly activated. And then really briefly, we're going to talk about some self-care. This is not intended to be a self-care training. There's only going to be a little bit at the end that talks about that. And I created just a little bit of a worksheet and a visual to kind of help process for yourselves what self-care might look like. Okay, so trust me, I am not a doctor. We're going to talk about physical health. We're going to talk about processes that happen within inside our bodies. The intent here is really for you to have a better understanding of stress and how our bodies respond. Please don't interpret any of this as medical advice. I am basing this training here on research, but not on a specific set of symptoms. So if there are any concerns you have about your health, always want to encourage you to talk to a doctor, and don't make any decisions based on my training. So that would not be good. Okay, so let's go ahead and dive in. So stress, what exactly is stress? So this is actually kind of a funny story. Jean, who is on the line, we were doing a training for one of the missions down in Skid Row, and we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma. And somebody asked, well, like, what is stress? And I was really embarrassed because I didn't know how to answer that. So I'm like, well, it's like a feeling, but it's not a feeling. I'm like, well, what am I doing? I know what stress is, but I didn't really know the definition, like the true dictionary definition. So I actually got this from the Cleveland Clinic, which, by the way, is where I was born and raised in Cleveland. So stress is a normal reaction the body has when there are changes or new demands. So the body reacts with physical changes, mental changes, and emotional changes. So stress technically is not really a feeling, but it's the reactions that take place. And I really want to emphasize those two elements of why we experience stress. We experience stress when there's a change and or when there are new demands. So those are the two criteria. I don't know if criteria is the right way, but those are the two catalysts for when our body creates stress or creates a stress reaction. So when you think about the things that are stressful to you or the times that you have been worried or you felt that you've been having some stress, most likely there was a change or some sort of new demand. So, you know, applying this to where we are today, and again, I realize we've been with COVID now for a little bit, for 9 or 10 months or so. My ability to track time in these days has been somewhat flawed, but which is a stress response. But anyways, you know, when this happened, you know, the initial thing that like the initial changes were like, oh my God, there's no traffic in LA. Like, that's crazy. Now the traffic has returned, but there are all these restrictions. You have to wear a mask and stores have new rules. We have to wait in line just to get into a store. Well, none of those things are necessarily like difficult. They're a little frustrating sometimes, but they're all new. They're all changes to our normal environment. You know, I never thought I'd have to wait in line to get into a grocery store. That was a new experience for me. And so that represents, there is probably some stress there. Now, it wasn't problematic for me. I was able to adapt relatively quickly, but again, it represented a change. And then, you know, thinking about these new demands, I mean, I think working from home really creates a new demand. Now, I'm in a position where working from home, it's quiet here. You know, my partner goes to his job. He's a doctor. He's at his place of work. So it's really just me and my dog. So it's not a bad deal, but I know some people have families and children, and lots of people are at home, and like, those are new demands. You have to create a new workspace. You have to try to help your children with their online schooling or try to balance the going back and forth of, nope, we're open, no, we're closed. So those are all new demands that we have to deal with. And those are going to create stress responses for us. So even though not all of the things are bad, you know, again, like for me working from home, it's not a bad thing. I actually really enjoy it, but it is a change and it does create a new set of demands that I didn't have before when I was working in the office. So let's look at different types of stress. So there's a few different models of stress. You could find a few different definitions of stress and different categories. This is the one that really sort of I found to be the most helpful. And it also introduced me to a new concept called eustress. So this is something we don't hear too much, and I'm going to explain it. But as I was doing my research again, this was something that I hadn't particularly, like I knew about it, I knew the concept, but it wasn't something that we really used. So the EU at the beginning of the word stress, it's actually Greek for the word well. So, you know, here you can see that it has this positive connotation. And then not quite the opposite of eustress is distress. And I'll explain that a little bit more, but distress is when it's not so helpful, when we're starting to feel negatively impacted. And there are four different types of distress. We have ambient, routine, sudden negative, and then traumatic stress. And we're gonna go into each one of those in a little bit of detail before we start talking about how our body responds. Okay, so here I have a visual of little test tubes. And I hope this analogy is helpful, and I hope it'll connect as we continue to go through the training. But as you know, every situation that we are in causes varying levels of stress. And in addition to that, each individual has a different experience with stress. So while we are all experiencing this pandemic together, or if we are all experiencing, you know, for example, you know, politics has been a bit stressful, like we're all experiencing that together. However, some people are really stressed. Other people seem to be doing much better. And, you know, we wonder, like, why is it that we experience some of the same things, yet our reactions can vary greatly? Well, one of the reasons, or the reason for that, which is a little bit complex, but how we respond to stress has to deal with our personalities. It has to deal with what resources we have available. It has to do with if we have any sort of mental health issues, if we've experienced trauma, if we have a ton of other stress in our life. As you have all experienced, you know, it's not as if we only experience one stressful thing in isolation. Stress can be cumulative. So I have work stress, and then, you know, let's say perhaps I have a fight with my partner, so I'm going to have interpersonal stress here in the household. So those things are combined, and they exist together, and I'm going to react to each one of those things, but they also interact with each other. So I may be stressed at work, and I may bring that home, which is going to fuel maybe some of the tension if there was some sort of tension with my partner and I, or vice versa. So I'm sure you all can relate to that experience. Now, going back to the test tubes, so just keep in mind that we experience stress differently. So this is going to look different for everyone. If we were to look at it as, you know, it's water in a test tube, ambient stress is just a little bit of water in that test tube. It's at the bottom, and the water represents stress. You know, it's there, but it's not overwhelming. We may not even think about it. It just exists. But it still has that cumulative impact. So it's still present. And it's going to add to other stresses that we experience. And we'll define what that is momentarily. And then there's routine stress. This is a step above ambient stress. And as you can see, it starts to build. And I did make a slight mistake here because I added eustress there, and I probably should have made the level of green of green water in there a little bit higher. But routine stress, again, going up a bit on the scale. And then there's sudden negative stress. So those are things that are a little bit more serious. And you'll see the one on the right of that sudden negative stress is basically completely full. And then we have traumatic stress, where it's overflowing. The amount of stress that we're experiencing, it exceeds our capacity to be able to cope with it in an adaptive way. Okay, so we're gonna go through and explain these a bit more, but keep this visual in mind. And as you think about some of the parts of your life that are bringing you stress, you know, how much in that test tube would it be? You know, is your work, is it pretty stressful where it's maybe at the right end of the routine stress, or is your work, you know, relatively stress-free and maybe it's not so far over to the right. So just keep this visualization in your head. We're going to go through it in a little bit more detail as we progress through today. So still speaking about the role of stress in very general terms, I want to show you two different diagrams. And the this first diagram, it's very similar to the next one, which I'm actually going to go to really quick. So this is Yerkes-Dodson law of stress. I'm going to explain this. But initially, this is a newer slide from when I've done this training before. Because what I learned in doing additional research is that oftentimes the model that's on the screen right now is identified as the Yerkes-Dodson law of stress, and that's actually erroneous. So, but I still want to provide them both because they both make sense and they both help us to conceptualize stress. But I learned that they were actually, that people often get them confused. So this one here, we're not talking about traumatic stress. We're not talking about, you know, a car accident or domestic violence, nothing like that. We are talking about routine stress that we all experience every day. And stress has a role. And if we look at stress, you know, we often think about anxiety involved with stress. And in addition to that, underneath anxiety, you could really see the very basic feeling or emotion of fear. And that's really what drives stress. It is a very, it's a very basic emotion, and it really drives a lot of our behavior. I'm sure many of you have heard of the fight or flight response, and we're not going to talk about that today. However, that response, that fight or flight response, it's the same thing, even for daily stressors. It's just that those daily stressors aren't to the extreme level of where we either have to fight or we have to run because we feel as if our lives are in danger. What's really interesting though is if we look at the fight or flight response from an evolutionary perspective, you know, millions of years ago, you know, when we were cave women and cavemen, it made a lot of sense. It kept us alive, it kept us safe. But over the past, even just the past 100 years, gosh, the past 50 years, things in society have changed so, so quickly and so drastically that that fight or flight response hasn't really evolved at the same speed that our society has changed. So sometimes we experience levels of stress that are in excess of what we really need. You know, I still get nervous doing trainings. I do trainings quite a bit and I still feel my nerves kick in. I notice my temperature goes up. I notice that there's a slight tremble in my hands. My mouth gets really dry. We'll talk about why those things happen, but they're all part of that stress response. And I don't really need to have that. Like, I'm not running from a bear. Like, I'm just giving a training. I'm going to be okay. Even if I do a terrible job, I'm not going to be dinner for a bear or for a saber-toothed tiger or anything like that. And I'm sure you all can also sort of imagine that or empathize with that, that sometimes our stress response, it's a little overkill. And there are some theories that it's because it hasn't evolved quite at the speed where before it needed to be that strong. We needed to have those really significant reactions. Otherwise, we would be food for another animal. Things have shifted since. So anyways, I'm going off topic and down a rabbit hole, which is something I'm really good at. So going back to the role of stress, it's helpful and it motivates us. So I don't know if anyone has had this experience, so feel free to share in the chat box if you have. But if you have like very little to do, like you still have a few things to do, but not a whole lot. Maybe it's at home or like, I think a good example was when I first started this job with UCLA. I came from an incredibly busy job where I was supervising, I was in New York City, I was supervising 8 different programs. You know, each program had about 10 people in those programs. Like it was a lot. And so this was a really like shift for me. And so the first couple of days, I'm really just kind of reading and familiarizing myself with some of the expectations. And it took some time for the work to pick up. And so I might go into work, and this is when we did go into work, of course, I'd go into work and maybe I just needed to respond to a couple emails and I might have had to, you know, put a spreadsheet together or something. But I knew that I didn't have a lot to do that day, so I wasn't really stressed about it. And I also found that my motivation wasn't really there either. So if we look at this chart, I was in that blue zone where my productivity level was really low. And even though I had all day to maybe put that spreadsheet together, I might have got caught just like watching, like looking at the news or reading a book or talking to some coworkers. And then at the end of the day, I'm like, I had so little to do today and I got nothing done. I'm like, that's crazy. I'm like, that doesn't make me feel very good. But then if you add a little bit of stress, like our productivity tends to increase a bit. And there's something that we would call, yeah, perks of a new job. I know those days were short-lived. but as your stress increases, typically your productivity increases because stress is a motivator. Underneath that stress is anxiety. Underneath that anxiety is fear. Now it's not to the same level of what we experience with fight or flight, but that is there. And so that serves as a motivation for us to get our work done. So every single person has a different sort of, a different optimal performance. And when we get there, it's the amount of stress and responsibilities, it's just enough to motivate us. It's still a little bit stressful, but we are motivated and we are feeling good. We are knocking out our emails or putting trainings together. That's when we're feeling like we are in the zone. And that is actually the definition of eustress. So remember, we had the distress, which we're well familiar with. And then we had eustress, which is E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S. That's referring to that optimal performance. Like we are still experiencing it. It's not always the most pleasant, but we're also feeling motivated and we're getting things done. And I love that feeling. I wish I was in that mode a little bit more often. Now, if you keep piling the stress on, we start to go down from that optimal stress, and then we are starting to decrease in productivity. So that's where it starts to turn orange. And then, of course, if there's so much stress, we could feel paralyzed, basically. Like there's so much emotion going on with all of the expectations. There's a lot of fear for how we're going to achieve it, that we end up not being able to achieve it at all. And so that's where we feel paralyzed, not literally paralyzed, but our productivity goes way down and our stress level is way up. So let's go to this diagram here. So this is the Yerkes-Dodson law of stress. So you'll see the rainbowy mountain or bell curve. That's what we just talked about. So this is the same thing there. But then we see that there's another sort of curve on the top, and I've highlighted it as simple tasks. So here I've labeled it arousal versus stress. Again, we can in this context, we could use those interchangeably. But you know, when there's a certain amount of arousal, obviously we get into that eustress period or that optimal peak where we are running, like everything's going great, we're in the zone. And then again, you add more and we just can't perform anymore. Well, what Yerkes-Dodson law adds to this is the fact that that only applies to more difficult tasks. His research, and his research is very, very old, mind you, but it's been, of course, it's been replicated and expanded upon. And I actually pulled a lot of this from an article from 2000, and I think it's 2006, still a little bit older, but not as old as the original of 1908 when the Yerkes-Dodson law was developed. But they found that, yeah, when we have too much arousal, too much emotion, too much stress, we're not able to do anything that's complex. So typically work-related stress, that's really applies, or we could really view that or use the example of work, because we're not doing simple things. Like, we have to make decisions. We have to use our critical thinking. We have to do multiple things at once. However, for simple tasks, if our arousal goes really high, our performance on those simple tasks can go high and stay high. That's because we're only using a single part of our brain, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, and we don't need to make all of those decisions. We are running on adrenaline, you might have heard stories or had the own experience of where something traumatic happens and some people jump right into action. Now, they're not doing all of these incredibly complex things. Sometimes they're just doing some basic tasks, but our performance tends to peak and stay relatively high as the arousal stays relatively high. Again, the challenge with this model is the degree of subjectivity, because what's a simple task for me may not be a simple task for someone else, or I should say that vice versa. What's simple for someone else sometimes is more of a difficult task for me. So again, there's a degree of subjectivity here. But regardless, think about how you experience stress and how much stress for you feels like, okay, I got this. Like I have to push myself, but I feel good about it. I'm achieving things. And when is it too much? And you're starting to shut down. You're starting to just become overwhelmed. And remember when we were looking at those test tubes with water, it's all cumulative. So maybe your workday stress is reasonably stressful, not overwhelming. Your home life, kind of stressful, but not overwhelming, but you put the two together, then you're in that orange or red zone and you're not able to perform as highly as you would like to in both areas, not just one. Okay, so with that, let's move on to some of the definitions of types of stress. So this first one, ambient stress, this is the kind of stress that we don't always really think too much about. This stress, it's negative, but it's something that, it may not always come up for us. You can view this as background stress. And some of the examples that I've listed here are like pollution, noise, world events that are occurring. Like, we know it's there. There's nothing we can do about it right away. It has an impact on us, but we're not exactly, you know, overly concerned about it. A researcher named Joan Campbell in 1983 did a lot of research about the impact of ambient stress. And really, it's because it's cumulative, it just adds a little bit into our stress containers. So it's something that we have to realize exists. An example for me is like when I was living in New York City, we lived, for those who have been in New York, who have lived in New York, we lived on the Upper East Side, basically at the corner of two very busy intersections. And of course, our apartment was in the front of the building. And so we heard noise constantly, from jackhammering, lots of horns all the time. And, you know, we just kind of got used to it. Like, we didn't like it. Sometimes it was annoying, but we adapted. And, you know, we'd be watching TV and it was almost like a, you know, it's just second nature. Like, you hear a siren, okay, just pause our Netflix show until the siren goes by and then unpause and keep watching. And like, for us, that was an ambient stress. And here the definition that Campbell uses is that characteristics of ambient stressors are that they are chronic, negatively valued, non-urgent, physically perceptible, and intractable to the efforts of individuals to change them. So there are some things that we can do about ambient stress, but they don't necessarily get rid of it. And again, another example, I talk about myself just because that's what I know. I have strong feelings about caring for animals, and recently, back in February, actually, I finally became a vegetarian because that ambient stress of wanting to care for animals, it finally caught up to me. I finally had the cognitive dissonance of like, yeah, I love animals, but I'm eating them as well. So maybe I should switch that habit. So, you know, there's still cruelty to animals, and, you know, obviously people still eat meat, which is absolutely fine. I'm not putting judgment on that. This is my own set of values. But I did make a small change. I made a change for me, and that actually helped reduce some of that ambient stress there. So let's move on to the next one. And of course, if anyone has any questions, feel free to put those in as we go through. So routine stress, this is what we are all very, very familiar with. So work deadlines, maybe personal budget, relationships, taking care of family, health challenges, you know, they are varied in degree, and we all have different perceptions and we all have different experiences where something might be stressful for one and not so stressful for the other. But this is the stuff we experience day to day. We call it routine stress, and it all adds up to our cumulative values of stress. Okay. So I'm not going to spend much more time on that because I think we are all well aware of it. All right, so let's look at eustress again. We're kind of revisiting this. So eustress results when the task is challenging enough that it motivates, but it's not too challenging that we begin to experience those negative effects. So again, this is about feeling like you are in the zone and you're firing at all cylinders and it feels good. Like, it's still exhausting, but it feels good. Okay, so now we're gonna go to sudden negative stress. This is not quite traumatic stress, but it can be close. And some of these things actually can be traumatic for some people. And it all depends on those perceptions that we've been talking about. Okay, so with sudden negative stress, of course, it's something, it's relatively self-explanatory. You didn't expect it to happen, but a demand has been placed upon you and you need to implement changes basically immediately in order to meet this demand. So for like the example that I have on the screen here is a car accident. Not expecting it, and when it happens, oftentimes our stress levels immediately go up quite a bit. And our stress reaction starts and we're able to resolve whatever it is to the best of our abilities. We probably feel some of that adrenaline, which we'll talk about adrenaline. We might feel a little bit shaky. We might be fearful. We might be scared. All of those things are stress reactions, and they're all appropriate for something that you would determine to be a sudden negative stressor, even like the loss of a relationship or just like the loss of resources. Maybe you lose your job, or maybe you got in trouble at your work, and that's not something you typically experience. So that could be a sudden negative stress. Okay, and then we're going to go into traumatic stress. So we won't spend too much time talking about trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder, but we'll touch on it here. So For the serious car accident that we were talking about just on the previous slide, that could be viewed by some as traumatic stress, particularly if it was a pretty bad car accident. And the way SAMHSA describes traumatic stress is that it results from an event, a series of events, or a set of circumstances that is experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or life-threatening, and that has lasting effects on someone's functioning and mental, physical, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being. So again, what's traumatic for one may not be traumatic for another. Now, I want to briefly describe the different types of traumatic stress. So here SAMHSA has laid out that it could be an event, a series of events, or circumstances. So an event would be a single event, such as a car accident. It could be an assault or a robbery or some other, lots of examples there. But it's a one-time occurrence. It happens and it's basically over. Of course, there's always the consequences and everything that happens afterwards, but the actual event has ended. So that would be a single event. Now, a series of events would be something such as if somebody is in a relationship that has domestic violence. There's multiple events there. They may happen weekly, they may happen daily, they may happen even more than that. So you can't say it was just one thing because it's happening constantly or very regularly. I'm working with someone who had very serious child abuse growing up. And so for that individual, she was experiencing a series of events from the age of 4 all the way to 17. Again, not one event, but events that happened almost daily. So clearly you can see how serious and how harmful that could be. And then there's a set of circumstances. So this one's just a bit different. And we could think about this such as, of being homeless. Maybe nothing specifically happened that was traumatic. However, we do recognize that that those who are not living or who are living on the streets or don't have a place to truly call home typically experience trauma at higher rates because they don't have that safety around them. Let's say somebody is living on the streets, they are unsheltered. They've never been assaulted or anything like that, but just the circumstances of being homeless, knowing that they are more vulnerable, not knowing where their next meal is going to come from. Like that is a set of circumstances and that can be incredibly traumatic for somebody. So I know that these are things that you all probably deal with on a very regular basis and see how that stress can really impact an individual. So when we experience traumatic stress, that's normally when that fight or flight response is activated to the fullest extent. I know I had said before that fight or flight is kind of always going on, but it's going on a much lower level. But when we experience a car accident, an assault, something like that, our fight or flight response kicks in normally in its full sort of capacity. And just kind of a note, I think many of you have probably heard this before, that there are those two things, you either run or you try to fight when we're in a traumatic experience. But there's also this third option that happens after when if somebody can't fight or they determine that they're unable to fight successfully or they're not able to run from whatever threat that is, they may go into freezing. And that's because that's probably the safest option. And just to go in a little bit of detail, and it's not necessary that I do, but I think it's a really good example. The woman I was sharing very briefly with you about of where she experienced a lot of childhood traumatic stress, she often blames herself because she often froze. Well, I don't want to go into detail about what she experienced, but as a child, and her dad was abusing her, she realized as a child, she can't fight her dad. She realizes as a child she can't run. You know, if we look at her at a very young age, at the age of five, a five-year-old running from dad is probably not going to be okay. It's probably not going to end well. And, you know, she was able to recognize that if she tried to run, if she tried to fight, whatever was coming for her was going to be a whole lot worse. So freezing was the response that took place for her. And, you know, to this day, fortunately, we've made lots of progress, but we were able to normalize that. No, freezing is not you accepting what was happening to you. Freezing was your stress response to reduce the danger, to reduce the bodily harm that could have come to you. And so that was very validating for her, it allowed her to not feel the guilt and shame of those traumatic experiences. So, okay, so let's move on from traumatic stress. Okay, so we have talked about the range of stress, how it can vary from person to person. We've talked about how stress can be a motivator. And I don't want to say most importantly, but important for this slide is we've talked about how stress is cumulative. And so, you know, we all have our glass of water, and every time we experience something stressful, we have those little test tubes of water, we dump it in there, and you can see as the more and more stress, your glass gets fuller and fuller and fuller. So no one needs to answer this question out loud, but think about it this for yourself. If you're this glass, or this is your container for stress, how full do you think it is? Do you feel as if you are at a place where any more stress, you're going to overflow and no longer function as well as you would like to? Or do you still have a bit of room before you hit that point? We're going to, near the end, talk about just some really simple things that we can do to make sure we can never really empty our glass of all of the stress, but we could always do things to make sure that the level of water in our glass is at appropriate levels. And so why do we want to do this? Well, because stress is necessary, it saves our lives, but in excess, it is very, very harmful to us. And so I'm going to go through an example. And of course, again, I use myself mainly because if I want to make fun of the example, it's easier if I just make fun of myself. So we're going to go through this example, and then we're going to start to incorporate the parts of our brain that I introduced during the learning objectives. And we're going to talk about some of those chemicals. We're going to view them through the lens of my brain. Okay. So here are some things that I'm experiencing. Now, keep in mind, I wrote this back in March, April. And unfortunately, some of these things haven't really changed, but here I am wearing my mask and I'm thinking, okay, toilet paper is a scarcity. Working from home is new and unusual and a new set of demands. This, should I wear a mask? And the answer to that is yes. I don't want you to think that I question that, although I get very frustrated at people in my apartment building who don't wear masks, but that is another topic. Maybe that's what I should replace here, is other people aren't wearing masks around me and I don't want to get sick. But then people are getting sick and now our numbers are crazy. And wow, that's a lot. Those are a lot of things to be stressed about. Okay, so let's look inside my brain. Okay, so we're gonna focus on these two key players. So there's a little picture of me and then my brain, and then we have the amygdala and the hypothalamus. So I created these little graphic people, and I tried to make them the shape that is actually in our brain. I had mentioned my partner is a physician, so I was showing him this. I'm like, is this the shape, approximate shape of the amygdala? And he's like, that looks terrible. I'm like, it does not, it looks cute. So I insisted on sticking with these, but they don't quite look like this and they don't have smiley faces either. So let's see what's going on between the amygdala and the hypothalamus. So before we do that, actually, let me just give you a really quick description. So the amygdala, that's a tiny piece in our brain, and it's really sort of the fear center. It does, it works with a lot of our emotions. Most importantly, it's the thing that really causes that fight or flight response to happen. So it pulls information from, at a moment's notice, mind you, it pulls information from our five senses, it pulls information from our memories, it pulls information from even from our own thoughts, but not really well thought out, because it needs to do it in like a split second. So, you know, if a bear happened to, we'll stick with the tiger. Let's say a tiger happened to walk into my apartment. I really don't want to sit there and think, okay, well, why would a tiger be here? You know, I could run, but there's only one entrance in, or I could try to fight it. You know, like there's not enough time for me to have this like critical thinking. That's why I have my amygdala. It's like, tiger, bad, run. And so it might be wrong sometimes. It might cause emotions that aren't quite right. It's doing the best that it can. Now, the hypothalamus is another part of the brain, and the amygdala, when the amygdala is like, oh, this is not good, there is something going on, it sends a signal to the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is what really operates our fight or flight response or our stress response. So we're gonna see that play out. Now, in my brain, or in my image of a brain, they communicate to each other via email. Okay, so I know that's not true. However, so remember, I'm experiencing stress from COVID and everything else. And so my amygdala, it looks at all my senses and it's like, oh, wow, this is new. There's a pandemic. What? Okay, we need to send a message. So my amygdala gets on its computer, says, hey, well, first it puts in the subject, hey, this is about a new threat. It's to the hypothalamus. Hi, hypothalamus, excuse me. I hope this message finds you well. The senses picked up a possible threat from the media about a pandemic. I cross-referenced it with some information I found in the memory, and sure enough, pandemics are bad. It actually reminds me of when he, that means me, the human, lived in New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina struck. I'm activating the emotion of anxiety with a bit of fear to motivate the human. Can you alert the autonomic nervous system so the body is ready to act on that motivation? Okay, so this is the message that it sends. Clearly, this isn't exactly what those messages look like, but you'll notice that the amygdala picked up on some senses. It picked up on my visual sense of looking what I saw on the news or hearing what I heard on the news. And then it looked at some of my knowledge of like, okay, yep, I know what a pandemic is. That's bad. Viruses, not good. But it also looked at a memory. It also pulled in really quickly like, oh, Hurricane Katrina. I was there during Hurricane Katrina, and this, there's a few commonalities. Now, it's not a perfect comparison. Amygdala don't care. Amygdala's like, these are some similarities, and we need to just pull in as much information within this split second so we can make sure that David stays safe. And so that's the message that is being sent over to the hypothalamus. Again, it's not 100% correct, because like, yeah, what I did in Hurricane Katrina is probably not going to help here. Doesn't matter. That's not the amygdala's job. Okay, so the hypothalamus, he gets the email, and before even responding, automatically goes to work. So the hypothalamus, you could view it as kind of the control room of the brain, and it turns on the autonomic nervous system. So there are actually two parts of this nervous system. There's the sympathetic nervous system, and there's the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system, you could view this as, what gets activated in order to allow us to respond to stress. So you may hear me say, oh, you know, a stressor may cause me to be activated. That means that the autonomic nervous system is now in my, the sympathetic nervous system is activated. My body is producing some of those chemicals. I'm starting to have those reactions to stress. As opposed to the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the system that calms everything down. Once the danger has passed, the hypothalamus is going to switch it back and it's going to calm everything down. Now, I wish the parasympathetic nervous system worked as quickly as the sympathetic nervous system. We know we can be activated at a moment's notice. But when it comes to calming down, like that usually takes a little bit of time. When I was driving to work, of course, that's not the case now, but you know, came close to getting into a car accident. Somebody else almost hit me, whatever, I had to use my horn, which I rarely ever do. I'm a very passive driver. And I mean, I was literally shaking. I knew what was going on. Everything was fine. It took me that entire way home before I at least stopped trembling a bit. I was still anxious, but most of it had calmed down. That was my parasympathetic nervous system. But it took like an hour even just to get that low. So anyways, we're going to be focused on that sympathetic nervous system, or when you're feeling activated. Finally, the hypothalamus is getting back to the amygdala, responding to that email of a new threat after the hypothalamus has already activated the system. Hi, amygdala, thank you for your message. I'm doing pretty well. Lots of routine stress to deal with. Anyways, I received your message and I have activated the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system to be exact. By the time you receive this, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol are all already flowing, so the human will be ready to act. I'm glad you activated a little bit of fear in addition to anxiety. Be careful though, because there is already a decent amount of stress hormones flowing from the routine stress that this human has been dealing with. We received a memo from the cardiac department stating that blood pressure has been pretty high lately. Okay, so now we're getting a little bit more information, but we're also seeing that the hypothalamus is letting the amygdala know that it has been activated, and now, now we are a little bit better prepared to cope with whatever is taking place. And so now the amygdala is going to respond back to the hypothalamus with another reply. Hey, hypothalamus, thanks for the fast response. Definitely a lot going on with this human right now. You're right. The human's blood pressure is high. I received a perception that this is the case because he recently had his blood pressure checked. As a result, I'm going to ask you to respond to this health concern also. He needs more motivation to get stress under control, which is really interesting. I mean, I know this is a cartoon, but this is actually what happens is that sometimes we get stressed about being stressed. And so then we have even more negative consequences about that stress. It can be a really damaging a cycle and sort of downward spiral there. But it absolutely happens. And depending on how I perceive this, if I don't really care about my health, then sure, I'm not going to, that's not going to stress me out. But my brain knows that I am concerned about health. And so if I have high blood pressure, I don't want to experience more stress because then my blood pressure is going to go up. So you can see how those things are being, how that's coming into play here. Okay, this is the last fictional email between brain parts that I have for you. So from the hypothalamus, responding again to the amygdala. Yep, I went ahead and activated the autonomic nervous system in response to this blood pressure concern also. The ANS is going to add a bit more epinephrine, norepinephrine, and cortisol into the mix. It's going to contribute to the problem, but I hope it is a wake-up call. As you know, the ANS has the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system team has been working overtime. However, have you seen parasympathetic nervous system team lately? I think they might all be working from home. So just a little bit of kind of cheesy humor. And that in this example, my parasympathetic nervous system or the calming effect hasn't been working so well because I've been a bit too stressed in this example. And also, as you can see, that the problems are piling up. So as we previously talked about the accumulation of stress, here you can see those two parts of the brain piling on those that cumulative stress. Okay, so I hope this, okay, thank you. I'm glad you appreciate the humor. You know, part of me had to put it this way, more so for my own understanding, because it gets so complex. So I appreciate that. And I hope it does help you to remember and to recognize the interplay between those two parts of the brain. But I think even more so than the hypothalamus is that remembering that the amygdala, that part of the brain, is just such an important part. And working with people who are experiencing a lot of stress, it can be really validating to let them know, hey, this is the amygdala, and you could rephrase it or reframe it, but it's just doing its job. And something that I like to compare it to, and you might have heard this analogy before, so I'm gonna go off script just a bit here, is that you could really view our amygdala almost as a smoke alarm. And I know that smoke alarms, they are there to save our lives, I should say. But sometimes they go off when I'm making popcorn or it goes off for seemingly no reason. And it's annoying. And like, sure, I get it. I know what it's doing. But like, I don't need the smoke alarm right now. It is just me burning a little bit of popcorn. Everyone is safe. So please stop beeping. Same thing with our amygdala. Sometimes it goes off. Sometimes we like really get stressed out about something, and it really helps to be able to take a step back. Like, it's okay. I don't need to experience this. Like, my amygdala is responding to something in a way that's a little bit more than what I need, whether it's a work deadline or something else. What's important is that the amygdala is giving us that emotion. We want to listen to what the emotion is. We want to pay attention to it, and then use our critical thinking to determine if that message our emotion is giving us, is it one that we need to respond to? Or is it okay if we just acknowledge that it's there and we continue doing what we're doing? An example of that, let's say my boss sends me an email and it's a little bit cryptic, and I'm thinking, like, all of a sudden I start to get a lot of anxiety. I know I've done this before, where you get an email and you kind of read into it, and then it goes to this place of where we've just made it a bigger deal than what it is. But let's say that happens to me and I get this email from my boss. You know, I'm not saying I always do this, because I have my own personal growth that I need to do, but here I am experiencing this stress. I'm feeling this, oh my gosh, what do I do? What if I'm going to get in trouble? What if I get fired? So a way for me to examine that is, let me take a step back. I need to stop whatever I'm doing and think, okay, right now I'm feeling a lot of anxiety. I'm feeling a little fearful. What is that feeling telling me? Well, that feeling is telling me that I value my job, that I like to do good work. And if I think I'm not doing good work, or if I'm not meeting someone's expectations, that I'm going to be disappointed. And so, okay, that's a good message. Now, does that email that I got, does it say any of those things? Well, maybe not. The email just says, I want to talk to you in the morning. Okay, great. So then we can look at it instead of me responding in that moment to the emotion where I have this fear and anxiety, and maybe the response would be, oh my gosh, Beth, what's going on? Is there anything? Can you give me a hint of what we're talking about? And then I'm going to come off as maybe a little bit, anxious. Instead, if I respond not to that emotion, instead, if I respond to the thought of, okay, yes, this could be something bad, but it could also be something not bad. And I'm adding extra layers of stress that I don't need. So maybe I can, it's not easy, but maybe I can simply respond to that cognitive process. And my response, if I really thought it out, would probably be, okay, great. Put it on your calendar and make sure you're on time to meet with your boss in the morning. That's the more appropriate response, because I'm responding to the critical thinking. I'm not responding to that emotionality, to that emotion that the amygdala is raising the red flag, sounding the smoke alarm too. It's like the smoke alarm goes off. It's just burned popcorn. No one's in trouble. It's all good. Okay. So that was my little tangent there. So epinephrine and norepinephrine. These are two chemicals. I think many of you have probably heard of these before, but you could, they're neurotransmitters, and they're typically known as adrenaline and noradrenaline. And there is a difference between epinephrine and norepinephrine, and there is a difference between adrenaline and noradrenaline. We don't need to go through those differences right now. They work together, they have similar responses, so we're just gonna focus on what those responses are as opposed to going too deep in some of the chemistry. But these are released quite quickly when that fear response is activated. They are produced by our adrenal glands, and they look like little hats on each of our kidneys. So we have two of them, and they produce this chemical, and once they're produced, they have a variety of impacts. And so I actually took this photo. I took this photo a few years ago when I was at Cedar Point, which is a wonderful amusement park in Ohio. And I used to go there all the time as a, like in my early 20s before I moved to New Orleans. And I love roller coasters. I still do. However, my body reacts very differently now to roller coasters than when it did when I was 25 or 20 and even younger. I'm 42 now, and I actually passed out for a couple seconds when I went down that hill. I've never had that experience before. So really interesting and a little scary at the same time. It didn't stop me, but it did make me a little bit more nervous. So anyways, let's talk about what epinephrine or adrenaline, what they do. So these chemicals, they raise our blood pressure. This is one of the negative things. I'm framing this wrong. They raise our blood pressure, and there are good things and bad things for that. So the helpful things is that by increasing our blood pressure, blood is able to move through our bodies at a much faster pace. And if we are in survival mode, or if we are trying to respond to something, we need all of the oxygen that our blood carries. So by pumping more blood, the rest of our body gets more oxygen, and then we're able to respond. We have a little bit more energy in our system. Just a little bit of information on the blood pressure. There's two numbers. There's the top number, which is systolic. It's how much pressure is exerted on the walls of the arteries during the actual beat. And then the diastolic, or the bottom number, is how much pressure is exerted on the walls of the arteries in between beats. So you can see that as the blood pressure, you know, as we constantly maintain these high blood pressures, our heart's going to start to get tired, because that is a lot of work. Like, yeah, it's clearly pumping more blood through our bodies, but it's also having, it takes extra effort to do that. So the blood pressure increases, of course, because the heart beats faster and it beats a little bit harder, but also the artery artery walls get a little bit more rigid. Again, that's all part of the plan. It all makes the reactions a little bit more intentional. And here you'll see in this third bullet, I have the heightened blood pressure is purposeful. We want to get blood to the important parts of the body so there's more energy. Blood has oxygen and glucose. These are all necessary for our organs and our muscles. However, and I know this isn't news to most of you, but heightened blood pressure over long periods of time, it can cause harm to the heart, kidneys, and the brain. It can damage arteries, particularly those that are really tiny, such as those that are in the kidneys, in our eyes, and in our brains. So, you know, you could imagine those tiny, tiny capillaries in some of those parts, like our kidneys and brain and eyes. And so that high, that level of pressure for too long is gonna start to do some damage. So I'm just gonna look at my notes really quick to make sure that I'm not, I had a whole narrative and I always go off script here. So let's see. Okay, so no, I think I covered everything that I wanted to cover. We're gonna talk more about this in a little bit. But let's look at the next sort of impact that adrenaline has. So we know it impacts our blood pressure. We know why blood pressure being heightened is helpful in that immediate sort of crisis. And we know how it's not helpful over long periods of time. Now let's look at our breathing. So adrenaline also opens up some of the really small, actually underutilized air passageways that are in our lungs. And that's just so we could take in more oxygen. Our breathing becomes a little bit faster because we want to get more oxygen, of course. We need that oxygen in our blood to fuel all of our muscles. But we also know if this happens too long, it can result in hyperventilating, and it also has the potential to trigger a panic attack. Now, I'm very fond of Eastern philosophies and also Buddhism, and the reason I bring up those philosophies is because one of the really central practices is breathing. And I want to say I'm reading a book. That would be a lie. I'm listening to a book right now. It's by Jay Shetty on How to Think Like a Monk. And I haven't gotten very far in it yet. But he says something to me that's just so, so important. And I love it. He mentions how there's one thing in our life that we have control over from a very young age all the way up until old age, and that's our breathing. It is always with us, and we are always able to control it. Sometimes a little bit easier. Sometimes it's tough to try to control our breath. But I found that to be just really a helpful reminder that when we actually slow down our breathing, when we are feeling activated, it can actually slow down our blood pressure as well. It can kick our parasympathetic nervous system into action. So, I know we're not talking about self-care, and I'm not at that part of my training yet, but remember that, like, breathing is such a helpful tool. There's tons of research on how breathing exercises can help us lower our blood pressure. This is actually really interesting. So of course we need oxygen, but we also need carbon dioxide in our bodies. So we need to have a balance of both. And one of the really interesting things, at least I found this interesting, is that carbon dioxide, it's actually really helpful in keeping blood vessels open that lead to our brain. So I don't know if any of you have ever gotten dizzy when you're blowing into a balloon, or if you're blowing up into multiple balloons and like you've expelled all of your carbon dioxide and then you get lightheaded. Well, that's a great example because we need the carbon dioxide. And when we blow it all out like that, our levels get unbalanced. Some of those blood vessels that lead to our brain, we're not gonna die in that moment, but some of those blood vessels, they shrink up. We don't get enough oxygen then to our brain, and we actually get lightheaded. And we could pass out. I actually do occasionally get lightheaded, and occasionally have passed out from getting out of my seat too quickly and then feeling that rush. That's a little bit of a different process, but there are so many ways in which we can really recognize these things happening in our bodies. Okay, so we saw how adrenaline impacts breathing as well as blood pressure. Now let's look at a different chemical, and this is called cortisol. Many of you may have heard of cortisol before. It's a hormone. It's produced by those adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands, to remind you, are those little hats that sit on each of our kidneys. Similar to epinephrine, it's created to allow us to respond to whatever situation we're facing when our stress reaction is, or when our sympathetic nervous system is activated. So there's always some level of cortisol in our blood, but the higher stress, the more of this chemical we have going through our system. And again, it's an important chemical, but it does have some negative impacts. So let's look at why it's helpful first. So it adjusts our immune system so the body can best respond in a situation. And this one was really difficult for me to truly conceptualize. So basically, the cortisol makes accommodations so that our immune system can be ready in whatever situation it might face. It's not that our immune systems, they're expending extra energy. And so if our cortisol is always a little bit high and our immune system is always trying to regulate as a result of the cortisol, it actually kind of tires itself out. And then it doesn't work as good anymore. So, you know, normally the immune system is like, it wants inflammation. It wants inflammation because when inflammation is around an area of infection or something that needs to be fought off, that's where it's providing extra support to fight that off. But over long term, that's not good. And normally, after a few days of inflammation, it goes into an anti-inflammation phase. But when we have a lot of cortisol, that regulation is off, and our immune system just gets tired. To give you an example, this time I'll still be talking about myself a bit, but a little bit differently. So I have a saltwater aquarium that has been a new hobby for me. And I don't know if anyone's familiar with the yellow tang, but they are a surgeon fish. They're beautiful, but they're prone to get an illness called ick. And it's ICH. And it's really interesting because it's a virus, and these fish have the virus in them all the time. It's just that when they get really stressed out, they also have this stress response. And so when they're always stressed out, their immune system starts to get tired, and then it can't fight that virus anymore. So one of the things with this particular fish is you have to be cautious to make sure it's not stressed out all the time, or it's not going to be able to fight off that virus, and then it's going to get sick. And again, this is something I learned in doing this random hobby. Thanks a lot, COVID. You've gotten me into a very expensive hobby, but at least I'm learning something from it. But the same thing happens in us. And so now I will share a little bit more about myself, again, just because it's easy and I know myself more than anyone else, I think. I had a very stressful situation right before COVID. We were doing a training and it just did not go well. It was an in-person training and I was so stressed out. I felt all of these responses happening in my body. I got sweaty. I couldn't think clearly, because that's one of the other things that stress does, is sometimes if it's in excessive amounts, it shuts down our ability to think critically, because it wants us to focus our energy on that survival mode. Anyways, I was incredibly stressed out. And then 2 days later, I got a cold sore. And I always know that if I'm going to be incredibly stressed out, that normally I'm going to get a cold sore within a few days, because cold sores, they're caused by a virus. It's a virus that's always in my body. And once my immune system gets weak, that allows that virus to become active. And sure enough, I'll get a cold sore on my lip. It works like clockwork every single time. So it's one of those things that I can just see my stress response system working. Unfortunately, I wish that wasn't the case. That's where it's not helpful. Our immune system gets tired. Latent, we all have viruses in our body that are latent, but when our immune system is not up to its usual potential, they become active, and then we're more susceptible to get infections. Okay, and cortisol and fat. So this is another, initially a benefit of cortisol. So it's released during those stressful situations. Well, cortisol has a appetite, or encourages us to have an appetite for sugary, high-carb foods. And one of the reasons for this is because it creates really fast energy. And that's going to be helpful for us. But it also wants to create stores of energy, knowing that we, stress might happen again, or we're still in this stressful situation. Our cortisol is thinking, okay, you got to bulk up, because we want to make sure you have enough energy to get through this. And so where do you think is probably the most centrally located, close to most of our vital organs in our body? Well, that's like right in our tummy area. So cortisol encourages fat to accumulate in that section of our bodies. And that way it's very close to organs that are going to need energy, centrally located. It's easy for our blood to access that and share it throughout our bodies. But as we all know, like most of us don't really want extra fat in our tummies. This definitely happens to men. It happens a little bit more in women. Don't know why that is the case, but unfortunately, and I'm sorry about that, it's more problematic in women. But even when leading active lifestyles, this type of fat can be really difficult to get rid of. Again, it's there for a reason, but it's not helpful, and has some negative health implications for us. So before we go into this sort of next section of the training, and we're in sort of the end, or getting close to the end here, I want to open it up to any questions that people may have. And then also I just want to address a few comments that I see. So like Denise mentions shingles, like a great example of some of those viruses that once our immune system gets depleted or gets knocked down, some of those ailments can start to take control. Oh, and here is, let's see, it's more active in people who are assigned female at birth because we can carry babies. No, that is a great question. I don't know, but that is really interesting. And I would love to do a little bit more research around that to see why those assigned female at birth have more of the problems with fat from cortisol. So thank you for sharing that. Any other questions? I think as I wait for any other questions or comments to come through, I think it's a good opportunity to just sort of connect all of this back to that central theme of, our bodies have these reactions. They are normal reactions. I mean, I don't want anyone to be stressed out all the time, but they are really normal reactions. It's your body doing what it was built to do. It's just that sometimes it stays activated for longer than it needs to. Because remember, we can't actively turn off the amygdala. We could critically think and then implement activities to try to deactivate it, but that happens on its own. So it's challenging. And also I find it helpful to know that this is just something that we do, because it validates it. Sometimes people give themselves lots of criticism or they may feel guilty because they're stressing out about something, or they might feel ashamed that they're carrying so much stress. It's okay. These are all very, very normal responses. Your body is simply doing what it is trained to, or not trained, what it was built to do. The processes are working. It's just that they're working overtime, and we need to incorporate some of those self-care techniques to try to get that parasympathetic nervous system back into action. So that's where I want to turn to this slide that says, well, how do you empty your glass? So we'll never be able to empty it for sure, but what are some things that we can do to manage all of that excess stress that we may be experiencing? Now, everyone's going to have different techniques, but the first one, stop judging yourself for feeling stress. I think this is one of the most common things that I see, at least in my private practice, of somebody feeling a certain way, then judging themselves for feeling that way. So, you know, feeling anxiety, feeling fearful, and then feeling stupid for feeling fearful. Well, we don't need that level of feeling stupid or feeling ashamed. Let's peel that layer back, because there's nothing silly about it. No one's doing anything wrong. It's just the emotion that we have. Let's learn from it. Let's think about it critically to respond to what's actually happening, not respond to the emotion itself. We do have to address our stress. We can't simply ignore it. We could, but it's probably not going to end up very well for us. So we want to take it seriously, because as we've gone through high blood pressure, some of the negative impacts of that, the fat buildup, the compromised immune systems, like those are all really serious things. And if we're experiencing those long term, we can be doing damage. So please, let's not ignore the stress. We acknowledge that it's there and it's normal, but we don't want to simply ignore it. So as I had said before, breathing is one of those things that we can do anytime, anywhere. And there are a few different techniques you can implement to do this. I prefer to keep things really, really simple. I personally don't like to try to control my breath. I don't like some of the meditations where, you know, you breathe in for a certain amount of time and you breathe out. Those are really helpful for most people for whatever reason. I'm not a big fan of those. I prefer to just be cognizant of my breathing. And so when I meditate, I simply, I'll close my eyes. I'll sit on my little cushion, and you don't have to do this in context of meditation, by the way, but I simply count my breath. I count each inhalation and exhalation. That process is one. I count to 10, and then I simply do it again. I don't try to control it. I don't try to control the ins or outs of breathing. I just count each breath until I hit 10, and then I start over. And if I forget, if my mind wanders, I just say, oh, whoops, looks like my mind wandered. Bring it back and start again at 1 through 10. In the context of meditation for me, I'll do that for 25 minutes. And just naturally, I could recognize my the stress level going down. I notice my breath slowing down. But you could do this at work. You could do this in a meeting if you're feeling really stressed. Don't close your eyes, maybe, but you can simply count your breaths. It'll pull your attention away from whatever's stressing you. And it's something that's always with you. Laughing is very, very important. That's why I try to incorporate humor in some of these. I try to be creative, and I know some of my jokes are bad, but laughing is a really helpful way to get rid of some of the stress. Simply moving. It doesn't matter if you're a runner, if you're a walker, or if you just want to get up in your office and dance when no one is around. Whatever it is, moving can be really, really powerful to help get rid of some of that stress. Being intentional and deliberate. This one's a little bit more in depth, but I've been talking about this not as directly, but when I've been going through examples about paying attention to that to the emotion, what is it telling you, and try to identify the thought. That's really that intentionality. If when we respond to our emotions without critically thinking, sometimes our responses are not so much in line with what's going on. Sometimes our responses can actually lead to more negative outcomes. And that's okay. Like, again, the motivation is there. The emotion is there to motivate. And then we follow that up, that emotion, that motivation. But just like with the smoke alarm, sometimes it's going off, but it doesn't need to. So if you're able to step back and just take a moment to feel like, what am I reacting to in this moment? Sometimes we're actually reacting to something that's not in the present. If we take sort of a PTSD look at this, not to bring it to the extreme, but even if you don't have PTSD, this relates, but thinking about someone who does have post-traumatic stress disorder, they may respond to a trigger, you know, perhaps a sound, and all of a sudden they're feeling fearful. I think a classic example, and I don't want to trivialize this, but, you know, sometimes war veterans and hearing gunshots or hearing loud noises such as fireworks can remind them of gunshots or wartime. And again, not to minimize that, but it's such a great example. So let's say, you know, if I was a veteran, and I am not a veteran, my dad was, but just want to make it clear that I'm not trying to present myself as something I'm not, let's pretend. Let's say I have some post-traumatic stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, or I just have a very strong stress response to hearing fireworks. And so here I am on 4th of July hearing fireworks, and I'm experiencing a lot of fear. I could respond to that fear and hide. I could hide under my desk. I could hide in my closet or something like that. But when you look at it, like, well, you don't actually need to have that response because you're not in danger right now. In that moment, I'm actually responding to something that happened years ago. It's not what's happening right at this moment. And easier said than done, of course. It takes a lot of practice. But once I'm able to critically think, okay, I'm experiencing fear. That fear is in response to the loud noise. The loud noise is reminding me of trauma. And so my response doesn't need to be to hide because I'm not in danger right now. Again, that is an overly simplified example. I want to acknowledge that. But that's how that works. And that could happen even on much smaller things. Things that, you know, actually I was thinking of, let me give a more realistic example. Not that that's not realistic, but I have a client who had experienced a lot of really high stress, not quite traumatic at his last job, but the relationship with his boss was, gosh, he really had some strong stress reactions. So his new job, there were a few commonalities, but they were very expected commonalities. Like, you know, he received an email from his boss where it said, kind of like that example before, hey, I'd really like to talk about this. Well, in that moment, my client, during our sessions, he would talk, he's like, I am so afraid. And so we would have to process that. Like, well, what are you responding to? I'm so afraid of what my boss wants to say to me. My last job, I would often get in so much trouble the next day. Like, oh, I get it. So let's look at this more critically. Your response sounds like it's to something that happened in the past, but presently you're in a different situation. So let's think more critically about it. The emotion doesn't really go away. It takes some time and practice and interpersonal work. But if we can manage some of that discomfort, if we can sit with that discomfort, recognizing that that response is one of those smoke alarms that's going off when it doesn't need to, if we can view it from that context, sometimes it can make that process a little bit easier. Again, it's a lot, much more complex than that, but I just wanted to give a few examples. And also I want to go to the chat box and thank you so much, Gilda, for your response. It says, she wrote, as we age, our response to stress changes. When I was younger, stress gave me fuel and determination to complete tasks, and it helped me to be more productive. As I got older, my body started to respond differently with blood pressure, weight gain. So I made small changes such as listening to music on my way home. It helps me decompress also. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, for me, the roller coaster at a young age, like there is no response there. I was like super excited. Now it's different. It's very different. But also with work, I am right there with you. I had no problems like taking on tons and tons of work, and I wouldn't really get stressed out. It was exciting. But yeah, as we age, obviously there's physical changes, but also we have more experiences. We have more negative experiences. And sometimes things carry with them different messages. You know, we may, as we, yeah, we build more of a context. So as things happen to us on a daily basis, we have more to compare it to. And some of those things might be negative in our past that get attached to that present situation. So that's another way in which as we age, as we get older, as we gain more experiences, the response to our two stresses may look a little bit differently. So making smaller changes, like listening to music, may seem like a really small change, but you know, if you're somebody who's used to taking work calls on your way home during the commute, just making that change to listening to music instead can make a real huge difference. So thank you so much. Being creative, this is such an important one. And I think many of us forget the importance of being creative. I think it's creativity is something that we all have, and it's so helpful to express. And I find that this is more difficult to be creative. And sometimes we forget that this is something that can be really helpful. Since I've been working from home, one of the things that I've been doing is I'll actually make, you guys might make fun of me for this, but that's okay. I do origami. It's something I've done for most of my life. And then I just kind of stopped. I'm like, I'm a 42-year-old man. I'm like, those are my own stereotypes, by the way. I'm like, I'm not going to be sitting here making origami. Well, guess what? That was a means for me to be creative. That actually relieved a whole lot of stress for me. And so I've been doing that. I mean, not a lot. Sometimes if I'm in a meeting where I'm having a hard time focusing, I'm just going to fold paper. I don't keep the things I make. Well, I have a few things around, but I usually just throw them out because the point is not to create something and then keep it and admire it. Like, no, I just need to get that creativity out. I need to express that need for me. I'm a terrible drawer, so I'm not going to do that. And, you know, this is really the most successful way for me to be creative. So that's the skill that I've revisited to help with that. And I see here, I crocheted a sweater for everyone in my family for Christmas. That's wonderful. Good for you. Good for you. I so appreciate the, again, getting that creativity out. It can so much help with stress. And all right, I am going to show you one thing I made. This is one of my favorite origami pieces. It's a little seashell, and it's kind of complex, but I love making these. So anyways, there we go. And all right, let's move on. Okay, so how full is your glass? So looking at it from this perspective, we have, what are the things in your glass that are filling it up? So here we have ambient stress, crime, homelessness, pollution, my daily commute. Well, that's not a thing right now. Work projects, strained relationship with boss. I made that up. I have a good relationship with my boss, at least from my perspective, I do. Maybe there's a slight loss of income. COVID-19, of course. Maybe I'm stressed about I don't have children, but my child's education, or maybe I have past trauma. These are things for you to think about for yourself. Like, what fills up your glass? What causes you stress every day? And let's counter that with, what are the things that you are doing to make sure that there's still room in your glass for more stress? Because you know you're going to, experience more stress. There's no way around it. So we want to make sure it's always at, that it's at manageable levels. And what I see your question there. And I'm not sure if I'm saying your name right. I'm not sure if it's Michelle. I want to say Michael. So I'm so sorry if I'm not getting the pronunciation right. But you said, wait, reading about climate change empties the glass for someone. So I'm going to explain that really quickly. So here we have emptying the glass, daily meditation, Hebrew. Michelle. Hopefully I got that right. Thank you so much. meditation, talking to spouse, walking the dog, deep breathing, going to therapy, binge watching. So this is funny. I think it's funny. When I updated the slideshow, I had binge watching, Tiger King on here before. I had finished binge watching that. So I put the show that I've recently binge watched, which is The Great British Baking Show. That's a stress reliever for me. Reading about climate change. So the reason I put that in there is that I find that along with creativity, learning something new can be really helpful. Learning something that isn't necessarily tied to your work. So I had shared with you that I have recently begun this saltwater tank hobby, and I have learned so much. It has nothing to do with my job, yet being able to sort of nurture this intellectual side of me that doesn't have anything really weighing on it. I don't need to do this for work. No one's depending on me to learn about, yellow tang and the diseases that type of fish may have. That's just my own interest. And so that's why I put that in here. And now reading about climate change for me doesn't necessarily relax me. But if somebody was stressed about climate change and that's something that they're passionate about, it may actually give them some sort of a sense of control. They're learning something new. So that was what I was hoping to try to demonstrate there. And so thank you for bringing that up. Eating mostly healthy foods. We all cheat every once in a while, and that's okay. Running 3 times a week, again, just examples. Yoga, doing daily stretches. So this is up to everybody to, determine what's helpful for them. And in the handout packet, which will be available to you, it will be up on our website, and we may be able to email it to everybody because normally it's posted before I do the training, and I was negligent in getting that out in a timely manner. I have a worksheet that is basically this, and you could type in it though, like the things that are filling your glass, and then you could also type in the things that are helping you to empty your glass. So it's up to you if you want to use it as an actual tool, or if you work with people who you think that might be helpful, please use it however you like. It's just a way to sort of externalize or get out what you're thinking about your stresses and put them on paper. And yes, I see it. Keeping a journal may be helpful too. That is such a wonderful idea. I mentioned the concept of externalizing. Externalizing is basically getting your thoughts and feelings out of your head and putting them somewhere where they can live. It doesn't mean that they come out of our heads for good, but it gives us the permission to not ruminate on them. And it's surprising how helpful that can be. So that can be a good coping mechanism. And started reading again, or at least tried to get some chapters in, makes my mind go elsewhere. Exactly, reading is a really great way to cope with stress. If anyone else has additional ideas for stress relief activities, feel free to put those in and share with with everyone on the line. But remember, it's up to each individual to determine what's beneficial. And laughing. Yeah, definitely. and with that, are there any questions? Ooh, I do see a question here. Any tips for enhancing clients' motivation to engage in these self-care strategies when they were feeling discouraged about the effectiveness of self-care practices, or stating that they're too stressed, busy to engage in self-care? Yeah, That's an excellent question. And one of the things that I have done, and Jean, who is on the line and who's putting out this, she's probably laughing inside because I'm going to bring up my favorite activity that she taught me. And I use this sort of self-care practice with clients, but I don't tell them that I'm doing a self-care practice. I'm like, oh, do you mind if we just do something really quick? And so I go through it, and it's called the 5-4-3-2-1. If you've been in any trainings with me or Jean, I think we both bring this up equally, but you start with the number five. What are five things you are seeing right now? And so when I work with my clients and like they're feeling really stressed out or fearful or anxious, like let's pause. Hey, what are five things you're seeing right now? And they're usually like, what? I'm like, just what do you see? So I can go through and I could say, well, I see my phone, I see my big water bottle, I see my mouse, my blue pen, and I see a yellow highlighter. Excellent. Okay, what are four things that you hear right now? And then they'd go through and identify, well, actually four things, not that you hear, four things that you can feel. So tactile, like I feel my butt in the chair. I feel my leg crossed. I feel my shoe. And then three things that you can hear. What are three sounds? So I could hear traffic before I was able to hear my dog snoring, which is really, really cute. And that's all. I hear the sound of my own voice, and which I'm getting tired of. What are two things that you can smell? And then what is one thing that you can taste? And you go through that much slower than I just went through it. And then when you're done, just check in with the individual and say, what was that like for you? Did you think about the stressful thing we were just talking about? They're like, well, no, I was thinking about this. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, how are you feeling better? 100% of the times that I've used this, they were like, oh my God, that was amazing. It's something so simple like that. But the reason I use that example, Tracy, for your question is that it's such a small practice. I don't even frame it as a self-care practice. And we do it together in the moment. And then when we're done doing it, I mean, it could take maybe 5 minutes at the most. Like they've recognized that they've already shifted focus. They're living in the present. They're looking at what's around them. They're maybe noticing things that they don't really notice on a regular basis. So that's one of those ways. It's a great coping mechanism. It helps you stay grounded, and you could do it without somebody really recognizing what you're doing. Not that I want to be coercive, but so that's one thing. And then also trying to help them to perhaps build in some of these strategies to things that they are already doing. So sometimes it can be overwhelming to say, well, let's add in 25 minutes of meditation every day. Well, that's actually a pretty big ask. But you know, do they have to walk to the bus stop every day, or do they walk to work, or do they walk to maybe their therapist's office or their case manager's office? Well, great. So during that walk, what do you do? Maybe listening to music during that time would be great, instead of listening to a podcast that talks about politics or the news. I think I missed a comment, but I remember seeing it really quickly about the media. Yeah, I'm watching news. Yes, I am right there with you. I have had to be very mindful of when I watch the news, because it was really having a negative impact on my own mental health. I'm getting incredibly frustrated and a little fearful. So yeah, I've had to manage that as well. So I appreciate the recognition and thank you for sharing that. And find that deep breathing helps. Yeah, definitely. So just some little things can be introduced into this self-care context. There we go. Struggling to find a word there. Any other questions or any other comments? while those maybe some of those roll in, I just want to say thank you so much. I really appreciate everybody's time today, and I hope this was helpful. I know we only touched on a very tiny piece of what happens in our bodies during a stress response. And again, I wish we could go into much more detail, but it's beyond my scope, and I don't want to bore you more than I may have already bored you. And with lots of stories about myself, you probably know more about me than you ever wanted to. But thank you so much for your patience and for your attention. I hope this was helpful. And also stay safe, be careful.